welcome back to the Sean Green Show. I'm Sean Green. I want to thank everybody out there that's listening. Hey, make sure you guys check out SeanGreenShow.com. Yes, that is SeanGreenShow.com. All the latest interviews, news, and podcasts are up at SeanGreenShow.com. Also, follow me on Facebook. It's Sean Green Show Media if you want to stalk me there. And on Twitter, it's at Sean Green Show if you want to check me out there. And our YouTube page where we're putting up videos daily. We're always putting up videos there. So I got some really cool stuff to talk about right now. And we've been trying to, you know, do this interview for the past couple of weeks, and we've been kind of like missing each other due to schedules and breaking news and all this other stuff. But there's this book called Hindsight, True Love and Mischief in the Golden Age of Porn. And the author of the book, and he's actually an actor, Howie Gordon, a.k.a. the ghost of Richard Pacheco. And he joins us right now on the Super Celebrity Hotline to talk about his new book. He's joining us, and we've been missing each other, and now we finally got him on the phone. So, hey, how you doing, brother?
I'm really happy to talk to you. We're missing each other because I'm the village idiot. when you told me you'd call me 7:30 Chicago time, I thought that California was only an hour different. So I'm 67 years old, and I still qualify to be the village idiot there. But I'm glad we finally got connected.
Well, yeah, I'm definitely glad we're having this conversation, because I wanted to talk to you about, you know, first of all, the golden age of porn, because I never really thought of porn in that way. I just thought porn was porn. But then, you know, when people talk to me, and I've had various guests on that was from that particular era, you know, as far as the golden age of porn, what years would you kind of place that in?
The early 70s till the mid 80s is what we're talking about there. And the inference is that this was porn when they were actually making films that were emulating Hollywood. So there was an attempt, albeit amateurish, to have actual actors and actresses and plots and stories as opposed to wall-to-wall sex. You know, I think that it's worth saying, you're 33 years old, am I right?
Yeah.
I'm 67. And I think whatever kind of sex is happening in media, when you're growing up, when you're coming on, when you're first having your first sexual experiences, that's the stuff that connects with you. And my grandfather, for instance, probably used to masturbate to French postcards from World War One, because that was hot stuff back in 1920 and 1925 and during the 20s and stuff. The hot stuff was coming from France. And in people who are now the adults, this whole golden age thing has kind of happened as a nostalgia from my generation, the baby boomer generation, for the kind of sex that we were jerking off to when we were coming up in the 60s and 70s. So to say to your generation, this is the golden age, this is what's hot, is bullshit.
Right.
Because that's not the stuff that you're thinking of when you're, you know, you're doing your business.
Well, I know with me, and I kind of like the porn that was, you know, back then, like the late 70s and 80s, because, you know, when you look at, you know, and I watch a lot of porn, you know, because I'm a very busy guy, so, you know, I don't have time to, you know, I'm, you know, a little bit TMI here, but, you know, when I watch porn now compared to, you know, the porn back then, you know, it's, you know, you if you buy one of those tapes, or if you buy a DVD, you're getting like maybe three scenes, and it's one guy, and he's going for like 35 minutes, probably because he's, you know, hocked off some pill or something.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, you know, compared to the old stuff, at least you had, you got some kind of, you know, you got some acting. You know, not all of it was good, but, you know, you can look at it. And you appreciate that. I actually appreciate the porn back then, you know, as compared to the stuff now. And even, you know, these quote-unquote sex tapes, you know, that stuff, it blows my mind. But, you know, hats off to you guys that did it in that era, because that was actually work to me. you know, from what I'm looking at as a viewer?
Well, in a number of ways, it was work. There was no Viagra. There was no Cialis. There were no shots. It was trial by fire, a trial by ordeal. And when I first started in that industry, I was absolutely terrible at it.
Really?
I was so frightened I couldn't get hard to save my soul. But I kept getting work because I could act, which was the reason I got second and third and fourth chances. Eventually, I did learn how to do it. But, if you know, I used to think I was a fan before I ever got in the business, and I would go to the theaters, which is where we saw the porn in those days. There was no VCRs. And I would be amazed that the sex was always so bad. They managed to find ways to screw it up. You think if you have two people who are going to have naked sex, just shut up and put the camera on. They had these people acting like they were having sex instead of just filming the sex that they were having, and it would come out so bad. And then personally speaking, as a performer, you know, when you're breaking in and you're learning how to do this, the idea of you watching me have sex, I don't care. Go ahead, watch. I'm getting laid over here.
Right.
But that's not what being an actor is like. Being an actor then was a lot like looking right in the camera and masturbating. And if you told me when I was first starting out that the job was to masturbate in front of a camera, I would have never been there. Because to me, masturbation was something that happened behind a locked door. It was not something I wanted to do for the audience, for the masses, and have videoed. But that's what it turned out to be like, because you could never depend on the woman helping you. You may or may not have a friendly partner. You had to get yourself up. You had to get yourself off sometimes.
Right.
And occasionally you'd get lucky and you'd have a connection with the woman. Other times you wouldn't. But you were still supposed to be able to function. And that was just really trauma for me until I eventually learned how to do it.
So take me back to when you first got into the business, right? Your very first scene, because you mentioned earlier that you were totally terrible at it. Take me through that whole process and what was going through your mind when you did your first sex scene and you just could not perform.
My first sex scene was the Candy Stripers. I was supposed to get a blowjob in a closet. And they were only going to shoot in the morning and then have lunch and then break for the day. The rest of the crew and cast, there's no other cast there. The rest of the crew was just going to come back the next day. And so foreplay consists of getting on the set. I had met the woman I was going to work with on the set that day. The director says to her, "You get on your knees." He says to me, "You drop your drawers. You suck him. As soon as he gets hard, we'll start rolling." And I had been waiting for 2 weeks for this to happen. during those 2 weeks, one day I broke out in huge red blotches all over my body. And I thought I had poison oak or something. I didn't know what I had. But I took myself to the doctor because I didn't want to be passing on diseases. And the doctor said to me, "Oh, you're nervous. You have hives."
Oh,
and
wow.
I said, I'd never had hives before in my life. But that's how nervous I was before my first scene. Okay, so now I'm in the scene, and the girl gets on her knees, and she's sucking me, and I get hard right away. And I'm looking around the set into everybody's eyes. There's like 40 people watching this. And I'm going, "Welcome to my blowjob." You know, yesterday, I was breaking concrete with a sledgehammer for $5 an hour. And today, I'm getting $200 for getting a blowjob. This is a great country. And back then, it was all film. There was no video. So film used to come in what they called magazines. And they'd be 3, 4, or 5 minutes usually. And they'd run out. And when film would run out, you'd cut. And that's what happened in this first segment. So they cut, and the girl stopped sucking me, and they're fixing her lipstick and fixing her hair, and they're tweaking their lights, and it's all brand new to me. I hadn't ever been on a movie set before. So I'm just looking around and watching. In the meantime, my dick gets soft, and then it's time to go back to work. She starts sucking me again. I get hard again. Okay, this is great. All right. This happens maybe 4, 5, 6, 7 times where they're starting and stopping. And at the end of the 7th time, my dick says to me, "Hey, hey, what are we doing here? Are we going to do this or what?" And I said, "I don't know. I just work here." My dick then took the car keys and went home, leaving me on the set. And when we went back for that next time, the director says, okay, we have all the hardcore footage we need. Now have your orgasm. Well, this girl starts sucking me like it's the home stretch. I wasn't even hard yet. And my cum starts running backwards.
Oh, my God.
Just running away. I'm trying to... No. Slow down. It ain't working. And I don't get a hard-on. This is like now it's about 11:30. For about a half an hour, they try to get me hard. Now, if this was an upscale production, they have a stunt cock standing by. After 5 minutes of me not getting hard, they pull me. Like, you take out the starting pitcher, and you bring in the relief pitcher, the closer. And he finishes the scene. Well, they didn't have anybody. They didn't want to pay a stunt cock. So it had to be me. So after 30 minutes, they decide it ain't happening. Tell you what, let's break for lunch. And when we come back from lunch, we'll get this shot, and we'll be done.
Wow.
Okay. So they all go and sit down to their nice lunches. You eat good in porn, even crummy porn. The caterers were good. So they have tablecloths and plates and forks and knives and everything. A roast beef meal. I go in the bathroom by myself and lock the door. And by myself, I'm sitting there trying to get my dick hard. By myself, I can't get hard.
You give it to the coaches section.
I spend the whole lunch hour in the bathroom by myself trying to wake up my dick. My dick is just dead. It's dead. And I've never experienced this in real life. What a thrill. So now they're banging on the door, come back on the set. We're going back to work. Well, we get back on the set. Now, this I can do for the next 25 minutes, so I'll try to fast forward for you. I don't get hard. And it's 1 o'clock, it's 2 o'clock, it's 3 o'clock. It's like 3:30. The set is starting to look like The Flight of the Phoenix, this movie where they plane crashed in the desert. The crew, they're all growing beards. They're sleeping on the floor. It looks like an airport, like after a snowstorm. Everybody is just... And I'm sitting there by myself with the girl. I think she fell asleep with her head on my thigh on the floor. And I'm kind of flipping my penis around, and I'm thinking about... I'm giving up. I gave up. I quit. I started off, I was going to be the next John Holmes. Now I don't even care if they pay me, because obviously I have no talent for this. I can't do this. And I'm just kind of flipping my dick around, and I start thinking about the first girl I ever made out with. I'm in the 9th grade, and it was the hottest sex I ever had. It wasn't even fucking. It was just petting. But it was red hot, and I've been having memories of that ever since. And blood starts flowing into my penis. And the only person watching this is the director. And he sees that I'm starting to get hard. And he starts waking people up and say, hey, we're going to get back to work.
Yeah, get rolling.
And he's motioning me to stand up, stand up. And as I try to stand up, the woman, bless her, Nancy Hoffman was her name. She was sleeping on my lap. And her head hit the floor.
Oh.
And then she was startled. And I lost my erection. And director comes in, smart guy. He says, whatever you were doing, do it again, and we'll get going. So I go back to that memory of the 9th grade, and boy, heat's still there, magic's still there. I get hard. She starts to touch me. As soon as she touches me, it goes away again. She and I are done. She had lost interest in me at least 3 hours earlier, and I was just a nightmare. And so I knew that, and I knew she hated me, and I don't get hot when girls who hate me are trying to touch me. It doesn't work for me. So director again comes in, smart guy. Said, listen, you just masturbate now. Masturbate all the way to orgasm. And as soon as the first squirt comes out, you grab it like you did it. And lo and behold, that's what happened. That came to pass. I managed to have the orgasm. She grabbed it at the last minute. When you see this scene in the movie, you don't see any of these things I'm telling you about. It looks like 100 other sex scenes, and it's just another blowjob.
Wow.
When I finally came, in my mind, I heard the cheering of millions. It was like the first Rocky. Rocky didn't win the fight. He just didn't get knocked out. I was able to come, and I'm basking in the glory of a successful scene, and a towel comes flying and hits me in the face, and one of the crew guy goes, go home, champ, sleep it off.
All right, so take me, A Star Is Born right there. So as far as your high point, can you describe me the high point in your career and maybe a low point where you figure, you know what, this is, I'm done with this business. Starting off with the high point, obviously.
All right, I'll give you a high point. This is one you wouldn't expect at all. I grew up with a mentally retarded uncle, and he was I was with him from the age of 4 until he left the house to go off to college. The director, Anthony Spinelli, who was the premier director of the era, with the possible exception of Gerard Damiano, who invented the industry, knew a kid on his neighborhood who was retarded, and the whole neighborhood took care of him. And Sam Weston was Anthony Spinelli's real name. Sam always wanted to make a movie about a kid like that. And when he found me, who had a background that understood that person, that character, that was time to make the movie. And so we made this movie called Talk Dirty to Me. And I played my uncle, essentially. I wasn't quite retarded, but I was very backward and very slow. And I was going to have the first sexual experience of my life. And that's what the movie's about. So, okay. A week before we're going to start shooting this movie, I have the crew and cast over to my house. And we're putting on the dog for them. We made a beef Wellington. We've got French cheeses and fancy wine. And the party is on. Annette Haven is there. And John Leslie is there. These were two of the bright lights of the Golden Age and two of the biggest stars. And they used to, when you put the two of them in a room, it was hysterical because neither one of them would back down. They both were top dogs. So they were just putting on their show, and we were all laughing and drunk. And the phone rings at 3 o'clock in the morning. It's my father. My father is calling from the East Coast. It's the middle of the night. And he's crying. I've never heard my father cry, ever. My uncle, who I'm playing in this movie in a week, has just died.
Wow.
And he's calling to tell me this. So somehow my wife gets the word to the people who are partying in the next room that I just had a death in the family, and they all start packing up to go. And as I'm saying goodnight to the director, Sam, we have a decision to make because I'm supposed to play this guy. And I can't even get home for the funeral because I was raised Orthodox Jews, and Orthodox Jews, they bury you 5 minutes after you're dead. I mean, they're in the ground, gone.
Oh, wow.
So I couldn't even get a plane back in time to go to the funeral. So I have to decide whether or not what I'm going to do about this. Is this movie going to happen or not? And in the end, I do decide to make the movie. It's a tribute to my uncle, who was a very gentle, gentle soul. And anyway, the movie gets made. Okay. Cut to, we're making the movie. The movie has a crying scene in it. And it's being shot at sunset in San Francisco, downtown. So in the picture window behind the actors is the bay at sunset. And John Leslie and I are sitting there. And he plays like a big brother figure to me, who's taking care of me. And I'm always trying to get girls to be with me, and they don't want to be with me because I'm a nerd and I'm a retard, and he's trying to get some of the women who want him to give me a turn, but they don't want to do it. So in this scene, it's just the two of us. He's playing a harmonica, and I didn't know it at the time, but John Leslie was an excellent blues player,
mm-hmm.
and so he's playing the harmonica, and that was new to me. And I'm crying and telling my tale of woe, and it's like a long scene. It's like five to 8 minutes long. And we're shooting the scene. So action, tears are coming out of my eyes. I'm going, oh, I'm so lonely, nobody wants me. And Bobby, he's playing the horn or the harp. And it's beautiful. Cut. The crew starts applauding. You don't get applause from crews in porn. That was quite a moment all by itself. But right at that moment, Sam, the director, like cuts him off like a water faucet, just turns it off with a dirty look. And he comes up to me and he goes, look, we're going to shoot this again right away. And he's got my head in his hands, and he's just saying, now look, this time, just let it out. Just let it out. Okay? Okay. And action. All right. Now, you asked about high point. This is the high point. The scene starts. The tears are coming out of my eyes. The words are coming out of my mouth. The harmonica's playing. It's all playing itself. I'm not doing it. Inside, I'm watching a whole other movie. The movie I see is my dead uncle sticking his head out the clouds looking at me, and he says to me, it's okay. Go ahead. Use it.
Wow.
The hair is standing up on the back of my neck. The cameras are running. To be an actor and have cameras running at a moment that's this real, surreal, is I don't even know how to describe that. It's the only time in my life I've ever understood acting.
Wow.
And frankly, I don't know that I approve of it. When I was a student, a history major in college, and I majored in Europe in the Middle Ages, when the theater troops used to come around to the villages and the small cities, very frequently the clerics in town, the church people in town, would run them out of town on a rail. Because to the medieval mind, you don't play with life,
yeah,
which is what theater is. And so they just didn't, and I understood that in that moment. I understood that in that moment. So the scene finishes. Sam is smiling. He likes it. We're done. Cut to, this is just a PS, which is worth listening to. When the movie is in rough cut, and Sam is showing it to the producers, who were basically Vinny and Arnie from Jersey. They're watching the scene, and they're going, Sam, fucking kid's crying. What the fuck is this? They ain't crying in porn. Get this fucking shit out the movie. This is bullshit. We don't want any fucking crying in our movie. Sam, what the... And Sam is trying to explain to them. Sam was he was chasing the great dream, the crossover film, the sex film that's so good, so well done, that it could play in regular movie houses. That we would make it. We would be scooping Hollywood, because the difference, only difference, would be we had full bodied sex, but we had a dramatic story here. And he wanted, this was the climactic scene in the movie. And long story short, it was their movie.
Wow.
They owned it. And so that scene got cut out. Sam and them had a three-picture deal going in. By the end of that day, they couldn't be in the same room together. And I called them up several months later. I just wanted to see the scene. It was the most incredible moment of my life. Certainly, it was the pinnacle of my dramatic life. And I wanted to just see it. And they said, oh, sure, you can have it, kid. I don't give a fuck. You know. Okay. What happens next is the movie comes out, and even without that scene in it, it's got such a good spirit. It's such a clean movie. It broke all the rules in porn. What is this shit? Just the relationship, the love between John Leslie and me, which is a whole other story. The movie became a big hit. It wasn't big hit Deep Throat.
Yeah.
That's a once-in-a-lifetime thing. But it was a big hit in the porn world. And we won every award there was to win. The movie made me a star, and it made John Leslie a megastar. And sequel. Everybody's smelling money. And the producers want to make a sequel, Talk Dirty to Me Part 2, but without Sam. They don't want him involved. And they are pitching us to come and make a sequel without him. And Sam is saying, don't do it, because we'll make our own sequel. We'll get somebody else to back it, and it'll be great. And I sided with Sam. And John said, I remember him saying to me, I don't know, they're offering me a lot of money. And every time I try to do something nice for somebody, I end up getting fucked. Which I guess you can't put on the ABC version of this, but I'm launched into this version of things for you, so it'll play where it plays in your world.
Yeah.
So he went ahead and made the movie, and I didn't. And later, we did make another sequel on our own called Nothing to Hide, which was even bigger than Talk Dirty to Me. And some people, it's listed as one of the top three films of all time in the adult world. And my character and John, for us, it was like we had a whole movie as a rehearsal, and then we shot this other movie. And I end up getting married in it, and it's a nice movie.
Wow.
Now, so that's the high point.
And what about the low point? What was
the
that?
Low point was Shauna Grant. Do you remember that name?
Yeah, rings a bell.
Shauna Grant was fresh cheese from Wisconsin. She was 18, 19 years old. I was in her first movie with her. It was 3 weeks on location in Los Angeles working for Svetlana, who is the only person I've ever met that I wanted to see get deported. She just was the worst person in the world. Bad. Just lie to your face like eating breakfast. That she just was not good people. Anyway, I did this movie with Shauna Grant. I had a love affair with her because I was supposed to be in love with her in my character. I was alone with her for 3 weeks in L.A. It's a good chapter in my book. I can't do it justice in a quick story. But we worked together, and then the bubble burst, which there is a magic to being on set and being in relationships that's over when the movie's over. And it's why Hollywood marriages are not easily defended, because you're trying to get the real feelings, and so you sometimes lose track of what's real and what's not real, what's just the movie. And I had one of those rides, and I came out of it and eventually came back, and I had a wife and baby, and I'm, okay. We all fixed that up. So that 6 months later were the awards for that year, and I go to the awards, and there's, her real name was Colleen Applegate, and there's Colleen, and she wants me to come to her room and have a drink with her. Her date for that award show that night was Francis Ford Coppola.
Wow.
Yeah. That don't happen too often in porn either. I mean, there's a lot of people like Charlie Sheen will dip in and pick up a queen or two, but this is something else. Coppola was taking her to it was her escort, and he said, so Colleen wanted me to meet him, and I said, I don't really think he wants to meet me. So I didn't go. But then later she called back and said, come on. And at that point in time, my wife and my kids were doing something else. So I went there, and we had a drink. And all the magic that was happening between us on the set, that was over and gone. And she was telling me about her career because she was she was instant celebrity. She was the fresh kid. And she had a run of 6 months where she basically worked with everybody and been around the block. And now was cycling out of it. What we didn't talk about was cocaine, which became her curse. The conversation went as far as me saying, are you still involved with that? And she said, no, I've stopped. And I said, congratulations, that's a good thing. And she told me at that point that she was in a relationship with a dealer and that he was in jail. And she says this to me, quote, if some people know that I know what I know, I'd be in a lot of trouble.
Wow.
And she says, I'm trying to get away from this crowd. And I said, well, that sounds like a good crowd to be away from. Okay. There's a knock at the door. Somebody else comes. It's my time to go on, get back to my wife and not confuse things. And I leave. 7 days later, I get a call from John Seaman, who was one of the popular actors of my era. And that's actually his real name, John.
Yeah,
Seaman.
I was thinking, like, John Seaman, that's a
he was,
perfect
he
name.
Was the greatest stunt cock of all time. The guy could get it up during an earthquake. He's the one that taught me how to do this eventually. But anyway, he calls me up 7 days later, and he says, what do you think about Colleen? And I said, what do you mean? What's she do now? And he tells me that she shot herself.
Wow.
And she's on life support. And I screamed so loud, my wife came running in from the next room saying, what? She supposedly shot herself in the head with a rifle. I don't even know how you do that by yourself. But she, in fact, did, and the parents' family came from Wisconsin and pulled her off life support, and she was gone.
Wow.
Just like that. So that became the low point of my career, trying to sort that through. What was the business's responsibility in that? What was my personal responsibility in that? I remember that Jamie Gillis was in that film with Colleen and I, and he was completely smitten with her. He was in love with her, and he was chasing her all over the set. And she's, like, hiding behind me because Jamie just frightened her. He was truly a cosmopolitan man of the world, and it was scary for her in the beginning. And he was having fantasies of working with her, and he was creating these movies, and one of Johnson Farm would show up and be scheduled to work with him in a movie, and as he got to know her in the movie, instead of doing the scene, he takes her to the train station and says, go back home, you don't belong in this world. And I wish that we had made that movie, and I wish that moment had actually happened.
Now, was that the moment that made you say, you know what, I'm done with this business?
No. What it did, it made me say, I did not want to work with the newcomers anymore. I was too easy a target. I like women, and I was needed for myself to make myself emotionally available to be able to do a scene. I didn't, you know, I wasn't the kind of guy that'd say, come here, bitch, bend over, and fuck him. That wasn't my thing. It didn't appeal to me. I wasn't able to function in that. I needed some kind of connection. Even, you know, in best case scenario, it was friends, because I learned that lovers doesn't quite work. I am going home after this. This is not a musical chairs deal where I'm going to go from star to starlet to starlet and keep falling in love. I learned that I did not want to do that. So I wanted to, after Colleen passed, I made it a point to work with the veteran women who had been around that knew how to connect and then let go. Instead of the women, I had had lots of experience with other people. There was a one movie years in my beginning. It was the hell was the name of that? Little Girls in Blue was the name of the movie. And I get a call from John Seaman saying, look, there's this girl who, she keeps rejecting all the men that they propose for her to work in this movie, and she wants somebody that's sensitive. So we're calling you. So I get the call to go down to be sensitive. And, you know, we get along and we do the scene. And afterwards, she's in love with me. The reality is she's 19, she's 18. She's not in love with me. But a lot of women, when you take something as personal as sex and you commodify it and you make it a job, that's a huge step. And when you're 18, 19, with very little experience to go on anyway, you need to turn that into love to justify it to yourself so you don't hate yourself, so you don't feel guilty about participating.
Right.
So, you know, that it wasn't a real connection. It was a manufactured one, but one that you respect because, you know, there's a wonderful Sufi saying. It says, don't invite the elephant master home to dinner unless you have room for his elephant.
Yeah.
And a lot of these girls come with a lot of elephants.
Oh, yeah.
If you're gonna make love to them, as opposed to fuck them, you know, you got to deal with that stuff.
Right.
And there are both sides to that coin. That's another thing I learned a lot in the business. Guys like John Leslie, who were the alpha men, these are the guys with the big dicks, and they took women's liberation. That would make them laugh for 20 minutes, and women were like Kleenex, and they got delivered. It's a line I used in my book. It was like the women were delivered to their cages. They didn't have any relationships outside of the movie business. They had all the women they needed from the business. When shooting would be done, they'd go hang out with men. They'd go to the track. They'd play cards. Those were my peers and my colleagues for the most part. I was married. I was the only one I knew that was married, and I'd go home to a wife after this. In any case, I thought that kind of male-dominating sexuality was where we came from, the stag films. That was the past, and that was going to go away. I thought our generation of the 60s would promote a sexual egalitarianism, an equality, that what would be good for the goose would be good for the gander, which is how I lived privately. My wife and I had an open marriage. She had as many lovers as I did, and I was as crazy with jealousy as when I was on the other side of that trying to work out. We were beating that horse for years. How do you do Romeo and Juliet in your great love affair and yet be free love at the same time?
Yeah.
That is not easy to do. In fact, it's impossible. But like I said, it took us 25 years to figure that out. And this was at the height of trying. We used to think of jealousy like racism or imperialism, just another ism that went with an old world that was to be conquered, to be let go of, to be moved beyond in the age of Aquarius. We could do better. I'm rambling a lot. Is this of any interest?
Oh, no, it's great. It's great. This is a great insight of what's going, you know, what happens, you know, because a lot of people think, you know, when you do porn, you know, it's just you go on the set, you fuck, and you go home. There's no backstory. Or if there is a backstory, everybody has the same backstory. Everybody does not have the same backstory.
Not like, at all. You not know, at all.
And that's the interesting part about your story is that you have, in a sense, a clean-cut, you know, background. You have a clean-cut way of how you deal with doing porn. And, you know, again, you said it earlier, you're not the type of guy to, you know, be derogatory towards the women that you're doing a scene with. When,
well, I don't spank on the first date. To me, that kind of stuff is like a high level of trust between people to be able to explore those kinds of things.
Yeah.
But the punchline to that story I was going at about John and myself is that I thought that he was the past and I was the future, and the future was going to become mine, and I would ride that wave as far as I could. And I was riding it. But what I had to see, when John and I did our first film together, Talk Dirty to Me, we hung out a lot. And I had to see how many women in the world want that kind of guy. Because I thought that, my wife, or one of my wife's therapist friends, made the comment that he's the kind of guy every woman wants for about 20 minutes. And then you want him to go away. You don't marry that guy. I had to see the number of women where that's exactly what they wanted, that kind of guy. And they look at a guy like me and they go, that guy's a wimp. I don't want any part of that. The genius of Anthony Spinelli, was that he put us both in these movies together. And he and I made about, 10 or 15 movies together. And between the two of us, we embraced a much larger framework of male sexuality. And he would do four sex scenes and I'd do one. And that was about right. Because the audience mostly was made up of men without women. And they like to see women get fucked. And get fucked in ways that the males were controlling things. They were getting their revenge. That's been the backbone of porn for years. What's interesting about now, in your era, in this era, is because of video coming along, the means of production have become reachable for many more people. So in my day, you'd see a film with maybe six or seven sex scenes in it, and if you were lucky, one of those scenes talked to your particular thing, whatever it was. Nowadays, in those days, maybe there were 50 or 100 movies made per year. Since video has come along, there's between 12 and 15,000 movies made per year. And no matter what your fetish is, you can get a whole bunch of movies just of that one particular thing. You want, blonde toe licking? It's there. You want women with one blue eye and one brown eye? They got that. Whatever the thing is. And one of the things that's included is more women making films for women, including, all kinds of lesbian porn and this and that and the other thing. So there's greater range, but there's also much more extremism in terms of everybody trying to top everybody, no matter what it is, to get some attention, because that competition is so fierce.
Yeah, and also, I talked to past porn stars, is that, due to the access of the internet, a lot of this stuff is like free, so they have a hard time actually making money off this.
Well, it's destroyed the economy. It's totally translating the economy, and that that happens in life. We were once a land-based system of wealth, and then that changed to capital, and all the people with all the land, well, they had to figure out how to adjust to making money. They had to have capital. The systems change, and people have to adapt with it. And right now, there's a lot of people making money who are computer savvy. That's the generation we're coming into. And you can, webcams, there are people. I saw a list, and I didn't know if I believed it or not, on the internet. 15 people in the porn industry and their net worth. And I think at the top of the list was Jenna Jameson and Ron Jeremy. And you're talking about multi-million dollars.
Yeah.
Nobody was making millions of dollars when I was working, except for the people that owned the movie, the people that owned the theater, and the people that owned the distribution system. Everybody else was just a schlub on a salary. And only John Holmes and Marilyn Chambers were making any money. Everybody else was working at a... I insisted on being paid at the top level before I retired. So I was making $1,000 a day. My competition was Jamie Gillis and John Leslie. Holmes was his own country. He got his own deals going. Probably, I don't even know what the hell. I wasn't on the inside of that. But that was a top male salary going on. And women could make more than that because women were the stars.
Right.
And we were essentially foils.
So, all right, a little bit about your book, Hindsight, True Love and Mischief in the Golden Age of Porn. One of the things that I found out that was pretty cool is that your foreword is done by Whoopi Goldberg. How did that happen? I mean, you guys go back pretty far?
Yeah. When I was already in the business when Whoopi came to town, she wasn't famous. She was an unknown in the big picture. She was doing theater. She had fallen in love with a guy named David Shine, who was a member of the Blake Street Hawkeyes, an avant-garde theater group in Berkeley founded by John O'Keefe and Bob Ernst, two of the finest actors I've ever known. These guys, they're like the Navy SEALs of actors. They work, and they were doing Grotowski kind of things and movement and voice, and they were very much against what they called blue hair theater, contemporary kind of stuff like Berkeley Rep, and they were doing this wild stuff. And David brought Whoopi from San Diego to be with him, and she ended up joining that group. And David said to me, Whoopi wants to write a screenplay, but she has difficulty writing. She was autistic, or I can't remember exactly. I think it was autism that she was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so would you help her do that? Because I was a writer all along. And I said, okay. And the next thing I know is that he brings Whoopi to our cottage. And I had already started in porn. And once I would become introduced as a porn person in the real world, people make all kind of assumptions about who you are. Like, number one, that you're available sexually 24/7, that's all you do is fuck, and that you're going to fuck everybody. And here I'm bringing this new person into my house where I'm with my wife, and I protect the marriage, and I protect the house. So when Whoopi came in, I remember I saying, look, I'll be glad to help you, but the first thing is you and I are never going to fuck. And she looks at me, and the look is saying, I don't remember asking. But she goes, okay. And then we started working, and we've been laughing about that for years. But so we did our screenplay together, our treatment, and she was planning on having the fantasy of working with Dustin Hoffman in that, and the movie never got made. In fact, I just saw the treatment the other day. It was in my files. But very shortly after that, she did a piece called The Spook Show, which was her cast of characters. And this warehouse at 2019 Blake Street in Berkeley, where the Hawkeyes, that was the name of the group, where they performed, sometimes there'd be five people in the audience. Sometimes there'd be 25. That was the level of theater that was going on. When Whoopi showed up as part of the group, all of a sudden, crowds started coming. And Whoopi did a one-woman show called Moms Mabley. Moms was the name of the show,
uh-huh.
Which I videoed for. I was doing video on the side just for fun. So I videoed all the Hawkeyes' work, and I shot this for Whoopi, which was a magnificent show. And then about 2 weeks after the run, which wasn't long, and maybe she did, I don't know, three or four performances, the Moms people contacted her and said, cease and desist. So that show never was seen again, but it was brilliant, and it helped grow her audience. And there's a place, I think it was PS 147 or 143 in New York, which was a theater that showcased new talent. And she went there doing the spook show, the characters, and I think Mike Nichols saw her there and said, I want to put this on Broadway. There was no foreplay. She went from nobody to Bob Hope.
Wow.
It was that fast. And, you know, we got to ride the ride with her. She was amazing. And the most amazing thing about her in retrospect is how she's grown into the part. This was a, you know, just a wild child of the 60s who now sits down and talks to presidents. I mean, it's amazing who she's become. And, God, she's great. Right. Just great.
Now, do you guys still talk, or do you guys still...
I just saw her 2 weeks ago. She was just out here. Her, you know, one of the first things she did when she got big is she bought the house across the street from where I live, and it was used to be the neighborhood community center. We once took our Lamaze classes there before Whoopi bought the place, and she was going to build her mansion here and her pool and stuff, and she needed all these variances from the city, and they were making it hard on her. And then all the neighbors started making it hard on her. But they wanted to, I think, to have their palms greased to sign off on some shit. And Whoopi kind of said, you know what? Fuck all you people. Goodbye. And she just brought her mom out from New York and gave her mom the place. And she took off and lived in L.A. in a series of husbands and took her all over the place. But her mom stayed there, and then her brother lived there also. And what happened was her mom died about 7 years ago. And about 2 months ago now, out of nowhere, her brother just keeled over. 65, had a brain aneurysm, and was gone.
Wow.
And Whoopi came out with her whole family. You know, she's a great-grandmother now. They have children young in her family. She had a child when she was, like, I think 16 or 17, and her child had a child at the same age. And so Whoopi's, I think, just turning 60 and now is a great-grandmother. But anyway, they all came out, and they it was a double whammy for Whoopi because when her mom passed, it was sudden also. And she was in the middle of 16,000 things, of course, and the brother just took over the property. And so this time with him passing, she had to go through her mom's stuff and her brother's stuff and all this stuff to figure out what to do with it. It was time to close up the houses to sell them. And that's what I helped her do. And I ended up, she asked me to run a yard sale for her. I'm a committed yard saler. I've been doing that for 30 years. And so after she had taken out what the family wanted, everything that was left, she said, just get rid of it. I could empty the house. And I said, okay, two questions. Do you want to make money? And she said, I don't care. I don't need money from this. And so I said, okay, because what I'm going to do is call in all your brother's friends and give them stuff.
Yeah.
And she said, that's fine. And then the other thing, I said, are you in a hurry? And she said, no, take your time. So I figured I'd do it in like 2 weeks. Well, then she leaves. As is so often the case with the successful Whoopi, you see her and it's heart to heart and it's your friend and you make all these ideas and plans and then she goes away and the next thing that happens is you get a call from the business manager and you get a call from the lawyers and they completely tell you, no, place this to be emptied by Monday because that's when the painters are coming in. Blah, 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 blah. So this easy to do thing turned into just absolute chaos, which is happens a lot, but you know, so what?
Wow. And it was really heart touching for how to do the forward for your book, man. And what else can we expect in the book? Because that's one of the main things that I really like about, you know, about this whole interview is just the book, and you have so many stories that you have to share in the book. So what else can we look forward in the book?
Well, the book is two things, essentially. It's the story of the golden age of porn and the times from the 60s through the mid-80s. And secondly, and more importantly, it's the story of my relationship with my wife, how we could live through those times and take the sexual revolution, which we were committed to, and try to incorporate it into our life and incorporate it into our businesses and make and survive as a couple. So it's the story of us, and that's quite a romantic tale. Porn is a pejorative term. Porn means dirty. Porn means nasty. Porn means grand juries. Porn means mobsters. Sex doesn't. And the idea that we've relegated our sexual films, our sexual art, to amateurs and criminals is insane. So we've got to take it back. The whole golden age where we were making stories that had sex in them, you know, you got to think about, well, what is porn? Essentially, it's a sexual aid. It's a masturbatory aid. And some people need some involvement in the characters to care about it. Just naked people humping doesn't always get it. You know, I was in a scene with Marilyn Chambers, who was a very famous star of the age.
Yeah.
And I had just gotten a blowjob from her, and it was wonderful, and I was done. So I'm on the set, and it was a home. It was one of these homes that had a balcony overlooking a living room. And the balcony is where the food was and the coffee when you were... So after I finished my scene downstairs, I went up in the balcony, and I was eating some food. And I started hearing these screams. And it was Marilyn. And the screams were like, you couldn't not respond. You had to go see what was going on. And when I went and looked over the balcony, there was John Holmes with that Little League baseball bat he called a penis, fucking Marilyn in the ass. And she was screaming. And she wasn't screaming, stop. I had never, ever seen a woman that transported during the sex act. Her face looked like when you see a newborn or a baby just crying full bore, not holding anything back, that kind of, wah! That's what her face looked like. It was just completely riding. She was riding the wave. She was there. And, you know, I'm watching this. I had just come like 5 minutes earlier. I'm getting another hard-on. That doesn't happen to me too often. And I'm watching this scene, and I'm thinking, this is the greatest sex scene I have ever seen, ever. And I'm numb by the time it's done. And for 6 months, I'm telling people, wait till you see this. This is wait till you see this. This is wait till you. When the movie comes out, what you see is they had the camera locked down on the genitalia. All you see for like 10 minutes is the cock going in and out of the asshole. It's like looking at hamburger. They missed the entire shot. It was all in her face. It was all in her face. Why? Why do we keep messing it up? Like I said, if there's sex going on in a room, I don't care who it is, the whole room will gradually notice it. It doesn't take long. The energy is just so magnetic. And yet we manage to make these movies where we take so many young women, 18, 19, who probably haven't even ever had a real orgasm ever. And they're having sex, and the director tells them, more animation, more animation. Well, they're not allowed the grace or the time to get into the sex they're actually having, because it's real sex. So you have people having sex, acting like they're having sex. Now, that's a recipe for just bad senses of humor, which is what most porn is reduced to.
Yeah, definitely, man.
But not all porn. Not all porn. And not all sex. I mean, you know. So, you know, there was a reviewer who saw Talk Dirty to Me in 1980, and the comment that he made was that porn will wallow in the shallows of human experience until it's made by artists.
Yeah. And you know what? That's one of the things that I like about you. You just tell it how it is, and you're very honest with how you put everything out there. The name of the book is Hindsight, True Love, and Mischief in the Golden Age of Porn. Howie Gordon is the author. He's an actor and writer.
Let me give you a plug about how to get it. You can get an autographed copy from me because bookstores won't carry this. So to get an autographed copy, and you go through me, and the address is www.hindsightbook.com.
All right, and you heard it there first. Is hindsightbook.com, www.hindsightbook.com. Make sure you get it. You go there now and get your autographed copy of that book. Howie, thanks so much for joining us, man.
Thank you. A pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, it was very fun. We'll be back right after this.